3 weeks ago, I started a sermon that I confessed I thought was about an hour long, and so I said I'd split it down into three. And I'd hoped that I would finish that tonight. And note the past tense, hoped. I'm sorry to say that I had about 4,000 words or so of my original sermon left to go, and I thought I would have time this week to edit it down into a single sermon. However, having spent all week staring at screens at the General Assembly, when it came to trying to condense down my sermon on Friday morning, I confess, the task was beyond me. So instead, I just decided to split it into two shorter sermons, meaning that we'll now conclude this, our first sermon in the series, next Sunday evening, when we will do the fourth part of one sermon. Now, we had a break from my sermon last week when Lisa brought us a sermon which should have followed my one sermon. But although I'd still not finished what I was wanting to say, I reordered things so that Lisa wouldn't have been preaching twice today as Lisa led our service this morning. But as it turns out, Lisa still wouldn't have been preaching tonight as there is still now one service to go after this one. So apologies for that, but hopefully I will bring you something worth hearing this evening. But first, I'm going to recap on the sermons that I've already given. So 3 weeks ago, we considered Paul's call for unity in his church. Now, that was an idea that we started to consider in our service this morning as well. The call to unity is summarized in Jesus' words from the Gospel of John at chapter 17, verses 20 to 23. As I said, in those verses, Jesus is praying to his Father, and part of this prayer is for us. My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you. May they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one. I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. Paul had been addressing the growing divisions within the Corinthian church at the start of our reading. And a fortnight ago, we started to consider why. Why have those divisions arisen? More importantly, what is the antidote to such divisions? And I outlined that much of what stood behind the quarreling in the Corinthian church was the common, and to be fair, not unreasonable desire to be wise, but wise according to the standards of the people who were all round about that church, wise according to the standards of this age of the world. And this world admires those who build human learning. But that also then assumes that human learning, human wisdom, can assist humanity to become equal or even surpass our God. Against this human arrogance, Paul holds up the humiliating, excruciating, and despised cross, the cross on which Jesus was crucified. Jesus himself prayed to avoid the cross, such was its horror. And Jesus knew that he could demand that his Father save him from it at any moment. Nevertheless, Jesus submitted to the cross in obedience all the way to his death, even when he felt forsaken. He didn't seek after his own human will, according to the will of his human nature, or the wisdom of his human nature, but rather, Jesus submitted to the will of his divine Father. And as I did a fortnight ago, again we start to look at this passage this evening with a very simple question. Why are we here? Why are we not at home, particularly on such a wet evening, but rather we're gathered here, gathered together? And the answer we see in this passage, an answer that is laid out so powerfully here, is it's because we're desperate and needy. We're weak, even if we don't want to admit it. We are wounded, we are sick, we are sore, maybe in ways that are obvious to us, maybe in ways that we hide deep in our dark souls. We're here because life and death so often hang in the balance. On the one side, though, in church, we know that there is a rescue, and on the other side, there is hell. This evening, as with my last sermon on this passage, our big idea is that God calls fools to faith through the folly of the cross. And in church, we are all fools, no offense intended. But it's in acknowledging our foolishness, our inability to be God, that we will be looking at the last of the 3 points which I had suggested that we needed to remember as we consider church leadership, as we consider leadership in the church tonight. Now, a quick recap of the 2 points that we've already thought about. The first of those was the folly of the cross. And we also considered the first part of the second issue, which was the false wisdom, the wisdom that confuses us, a wisdom which is expressed through human words and human persuasion. What is being said is that although the wisdom of the world can seem to be correct, rational, arguments not to believe in God, they seem sensible so often. Or if we admit that there is a God, we can hold that God wanting when measured up against our own standards. Because how could a God allow a world to behave as our world does? However, if wise words were the key to reaching up to God, then surely only the cleverest and most intelligently gifted could rise to that height, and the rest of us would be left to our own devices. We wouldn't be able to achieve the rescue that God promises. And that is not the will of God. For his love and the rescue that he offers to all are offered to all, not just one or two. So the third point that we are going to finally look at this evening is the faith of the successful call. How preaching is folly, but how we recognize that it is so much more than folly. But having run through that quick recap of everything that we've gone through so far, I think before I launch into the next portion of the service, we will stop and we will sing our next hymn. The folly of preaching, something that, to be honest, is a bit uncomfortable for me to talk about. Am I just making a waste of my life as I stand here? I hope not. I pray not. But in our sermon, or in my sermon this evening, I want to think about the folly of preaching in two senses. The first one is the message itself. It's what we preach, what I preach. Jesus Christ and him crucified, him risen from the dead, and him ascended to heaven. Yet this is a foolish message in the eyes of the world, particularly the cross. How could a naked, bleeding, dying man be the power of God's salvation? That is just foolish. The weak, the condemned, the dying, and the dead. How can salvation come from that? And it's not just that. It's also folly of preaching in the sense of folly of the means of communicating the message. What we're doing here today is fundamentally silly, unless it is by the power of God. Why should we sit and listen to an ancient book be described by someone standing at the front and preaching at you for a certain length of time? In our tradition, it's because through simple, unadorned preaching, not through eloquent, wise words of wisdom, but through simple preaching, that God helps to make Jesus Christ known. Simple preaching, and obviously in God's own word, in our Bible. In this, again, we see Christ. If we look a little bit ahead in 1 Corinthians, I'll show you what Paul is talking about when he's talking about the weakness of preaching. If you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 1 to 5, we read the following. "And so it was with me, brothers and sisters, when I," this is Paul, "came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you, except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness, with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power." What Paul is saying here is that it is both. The message is weak and foolish in the eyes of the world. Also, the means of declaring that message is itself foolishness. Yet somehow, in the midst of all this, when the gospel of Jesus Christ is preached and proclaimed, people do come to believe and are thereby saved. And we must have faith in that. Faith that God will move people using his gospel, using his word in the Bible, using his followers, us fellow Christians. But why then, if this gospel message is open for all to believe in, why do intellectually gifted people often reject the gospel? Paul says that it isn't really about what people say it is about. And he gives two groups of people and identifies the objections that they have, but ultimately, their objections aren't really about those things. I'm going to draw a couple of parallel examples. If we look at the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland last week, or the forthcoming election that we are going to have on the 4th of July, in both of these things, we'll see many people trying to sell us their vision for the church or their vision for the United Kingdom and how we should be run, what should be prioritized, and what is a policy that needs to be dropped. So there's a lot of pressure on getting this persuasion correct. Of the things that politicians must learn quickly, one of the things, that politicians must learn quickly is how to figure out what people's objections are to what you're saying. And some are eager to do this and try hard to figure out what people might say and come up with carefully crafted counter-arguments to those points. They would say things like, "You're saying this, but this is wrong, and this is why you're wrong in thinking this." However, it may also be that a politician, having used their best persuasive arguments, they then find out that the person that they're trying to persuade works for another political party entirely. So really, their objections about what the politician is proposing aren't the key issues. There was something else going on, which meant that the politician was never going to be able to persuade this individual or win their vote for support. What was at issue was the fact that this person belonged to a different political party. And that's what Paul is saying what happens when we're talking about the gospel. He says that the Jews demanded signs and the Greeks, or the Gentiles, seek wisdom. But actually, it's not about that. Yes, the Jews seek signs. In other words, they want certainty and they want control. They have a view of themselves that they are the judges and God is in the defender's chair. You may be familiar with C.S. Lewis's essay, God in the Dock. Now, we are a very reasonable people. And if we are reasonable enough, we are willing to allow God to give his defense for why he allows suffering in the world and that kind of thing. Ultimately, with that mindset, we say that we are the judges and he, our God, is the one who has to give the defense of who he is. God is in the dock and we are the judges. And Paul says that the Jews say, give us signs, prove it that you are who you say you are, we won't believe. Many other people say the same sorts of things. Other people said the same things to Jesus. Prove it. But here's the thing. When Jesus did give signs, it only ever served to increase their rejection of him. After Jesus had raised his friend Lazarus from the dead, surely a sign above all other signs that Jesus was someone from God. Their reaction was, yeah, he's performing these signs. We'll have to figure out what to do with him. How can we kill him? They weren't looking for signs to prove who Jesus was. It wasn't about the signs at all, but it was about something else. Similarly, the Greeks, on the other hand, they sought wisdom. They wanted wisdom, and that would be an important thing for them. And let's not pretend that our God doesn't care about wisdom as well. If you go to the Old Testament, you'll find an entire section of books that's called the wisdom literature. It defines wisdom in a very specific ways. We read in the book of Proverbs, chapter 1, verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The Jews thought of themselves as judges, and God was in the dock. The Greeks thought of themselves as gods, and God then is on the outside of their lives, playing a supporting role. If you've ever read Greek literature and mythology, you'll know that the Greek gods are always on the outside, just waiting to help or, more often, hinder human beings. They say they wanted wisdom, but at the end of the day, it wasn't about seeking true wisdom. What the Greeks were interested in was logic and reasoning. So Paul says in verse 23, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. For the Jews, it was a stumbling block. It was a scandal. They didn't believe that something as horrific as the cross could be the power of God. The Greeks looked at that and said, are you serious? Have you read Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle? Do you think the cross measures up to that? It's foolishness. At the end of the day, for both groups, it wasn't about signs or wisdom. It was about unbelief. In fact, what they were building their homes on was the sinking sand on their desire to put themselves in the middle and to put God on the periphery, playing a supporting role in their lives, requiring a God to explain himself to them or requiring a God to show signs, to prove himself to them. Essentially, what they're doing is a repetition of the sin of the Tower of Babel. They thought by Jewish sign-seeking or Greek wisdom-seeking that they could build up one step after another, a tower that would reach up to God, so that eventually they would be able to claim whatever they wanted to was from God. At the end of the day, in trying to reach up to that, not only did they come nowhere near reaching God, but eventually they only condemned themselves by rejecting the gospel that God himself has come down to us. That's where the gospel is. We see here that in confusion, the entire human race tries in a variety of ways, but still fails to reach up to God. God delights to save those who believe that Christ came down to die for us on the cross. In fact, at the end of this, we see that the cross is not really folly, and it's humanity who are the fools. We want to figure out a way to save ourselves apart from God. That is so often the goal of humanity, to sort ourselves out, for us to do the work, because we are the ones that matter. But it's the cross. It is the cross at the center of our faith. That is truly what matters. That cross is not foolish. Do you know that? If you do, what are you to do with that knowledge? That the cross is not foolish, that the cross is the power of God. Well, for that, come back next week for what I promise will absolutely be the last part of this sermon.